Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined today by Kate.
Hi.
And Adrian.
Hey, how's it going?
This week, we are going to talk about posthumous releases and unfinished works and kind of like, where's the line between honoring the dead and exploiting their image for money? And also just like, what does and doesn't need to be released? Just that whole conversation. But before we get into that, what have you guys been enjoying lately? Does anyone want to go first?
I'll go first. Marvel Rivals. I'm going to say that I'm enjoying it because I'm enjoying it. I'm having fun. It's fun. It's fun to play ranked. Everyone is great.
Are you telling us that or yourself?
My wife came home and she's like, "What'd you do today?" And I was like, "Well, I did some work and I played a little bit of Marvel Rivals." She's like, "Did you have fun?" And I was like, "No, I did not, because I didn't rank up." When you're ranking up, it's fun, but the game itself is fun. I'm really enjoying it. And as someone who really loved Overwatch and is sad to see what it has become, Marvel Rivals has been really great, and I hope that they keep supporting it. And if you're playing it, let me know. And I was gonna say,
like, that's extremely how you know it was an Overwatch killer, because you have to gaslight yourself into believing you had fun while playing it. That is how Marvel Rivals has solidified itself as the real Overwatch.
That's
killer.
Too real.
Yeah, yeah. When that MVP thing comes up, nothing else matters. You know, you're like, oh, all of the toxicity that was happening before, it's fine. You know.
Mm-hmm. I did play Marvel Rivals for the first time the other day, and the one thing that kind of bummed me out was that it doesn't automatically show you the play of the game, because for some reason when I was playing Overwatch, something I genuinely enjoyed was getting to the end and having a random username pop up, and I'm like, okay, what's the coolest thing that happened in this game according to this? Or even better, when you're the play of the game.
I'll say better than Overwatch is that everyone gets a play of the game. You get to click on everybody's character and see what everyone's best play of the game
was.
That's really cool, actually.
Which I like better. So I think, you know, whoever it is, you can just go on them, click on their thing in like the loading thing. Don't like exit all the way out, but like in the loading thing, you get whoever's play the game was. It's also super easy to save your clips and stuff too. I am having a lot of fun. I'm just like in like elo hell right now, where I was one game away from going to diamond, and then I'm like back down. It's just ebb and flow.
Look, I have not played it yet because I'm very aware of my personality, and thus I have to have a life and do things.
That is also true. It is very, very addicting, and I have not played other things because of it. So that's probably why. Good. Thanks for bringing this up. I'm going to go play something else tonight. I'm going to go play some, I don't know, find some co-op game to play with my wife and have some fun.
Do it. You guys should play Subnautica before the sequel comes out.
I don't even know what that is. What is that?
It's literally just a crafting survival game, but there's a storyline to it, and it's all like underwater, so you have to manage your oxygen as well as like your food and water intake. And also it's kind of scary as hell, because you go deep in the ocean and there's monsters and you don't have weapons in that game.
Ooh, fun. I like it.
Or I think your best weapon is a knife.
Yeah, it's really fun to watch other people play, because it's not a horror game at all.
No, but it
like,
scares the hell
way
out
that
of you.
People get so scared just because open water is in fact the worst thing. Like that is just
terrifying
show.
For me. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great game. I recommend it. My wife and I played it early in the pandemic. We just like had it downloaded and we were like, let's try it. Let's see what it is. And it became like the thing we did every day until we finished it.
Yeah. 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 We're probably going to play Worlds of Aria. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
I haven't heard of that one.
It's a lot of fun, man. It's like, I describe it to my friends as like Baldur's Gate 3 Lite. Like it's very simplified, like Dungeons and Dragons kind of pick up and play kind of thing. Review on the site for it. It's on everything, but it's so much fun. It's a really good, relaxing, fun, goofy game that deserves more love and is fun. I definitely enjoy playing that, so that's what I'm going to do tonight.
Yeah,
which, if you would like to learn more about it, you can read Adrian's review where he talks about the co-op and playing it on Switch.
It's very good on the Switch. Plug.
Is it local co-op or online?
Local and online.
Okay, so that's killer. All right. Kate, what about you? What have you been enjoying?
I got laid off. And you know what saved me from my layoff sads for like an hour and a half exactly, because it was the perfect length? Love Hurts. That movie.
Oh, I need to see that.
I think it slaps. It took me out of like the big funk that I was in, obviously, that day. And ultimately, like, the big thing for me is that it is just good action. Like, some of the things that people have been complaining about is some of the corniness in it, but it is a spaghetti Western. Like, there is a point in the film right after the first act where everything kicks off, and it's a spaghetti Western, which means it's absurd, it's fun, it's violent, and Kihi Kwan is, like, phenomenal, like, action-wise. It's shot brilliantly. A lot of the fight choreography is very inventive, especially from the camera angles that you do see it from. Mm-hmm. And what I really appreciate about it as well is that Marshawn Lynch was my MVP of the movie because I did not expect him.
I was going to ask you, how's Marshawn in it? Because he's the best thing in anything. I love it. Fuck yeah.
I know. It's crazy. Because so I saw him in that Mars Experiment TV show thing. I saw that and I was like, okay, cool, he's funny. I like it when he does those promos on Thursday Night Football where they like send him to different countries, like that's fun. But I was like, that's just him being Marshawn. Like, how does he act with like a scene partner? Phenomenal. Like, that's the answer. Yeah, like,
right. I enjoyed him a lot genuinely in Bottoms.
Oh, okay, see, like, I did not see Bottoms, so there we go.
Yeah.
No, right. I'm very excited. Give Marshawn Lynch all the things. I feel like I don't know if he can do lead, but I just want him to be as a duo in things. I think he can do lead if you gave Marshawn Lynch a buddy comedy action movie.
Who would you fantastic. Want? Yep, that's perfect. Who's he playing with?
Oh, it had so he would be the orange. So we need a banana. Yeah, so we need a tall, mostly thin person.
Ooh. One of the Skarsgards.
Actually, Alex Skarsgard and Marshawn Lynch in a buddy comedy. That is what I want.
Print I feel it, like I was speaking something insane it. Into the world, but I kind no. of agree.
Well, because like all the Skarsgards are like increasingly funny. Like you could even put like Bill's the dad, right?
Stellan's the
Stellan
dad.
Is the dad. Bill's the creepy Nosferatu man, right?
Yes.
Okay. yes, put old man Skarsgård in there, and I think it would be good. Like a Skarsgård.
Absolutely, I would watch
or
that.
Or make each act a different Skarsgård brother.
Oh, he has Sean Astin as well in this.
He's very funny. Man.
God, I'm so excited packed. To see this.
It's packed, and I think what sucks is there is a review for it up on our site. But obviously, y'all know what it is by this point. It's up on the site. Jason gave it a 6 out of 10. I don't disagree with him. Ariana DeBose remains a person who has the most cursed acting roles post-Oscars that I have ever known because she's not good in this movie. But aww. I think if you allow her to not detract from everything else, or if you just look at it from as a pure spaghetti Western, it's really good. But I think at the very least, you're going to have fun. Like, I think that 6 can work even if you're not all dialed in, because I think it's a good time at the movies no matter what.
Yeah, I'm going for Kwan and Marshawn. So as long as those two are good, I'm happy, I think.
Exactly. I wanted to see it for Kihi Kwan more than anything. So, yeah.
He's
all right, that's
so
good.
Great. He's adorable and violent. Like, you can see him be a cute
everything
little,
you love.
Yes, you can see him be a cute little realtor who makes hard cookies and then, like, smash somebody's face in with his fists.
I need it. Great. It's going to be so good. For me, my section is going to be incredibly Canadian. Not because of any, like, recent political happenings, just this is somehow what has come across my plate. One, every now and then I will pick a band and just listen through their whole discography. And right now I'm working my way through the Tragically Hip. Do you guys know The Hip?
No.
This is like the Canadian band. Like, if there is a band that represents Canada, it's them.
Did you have to pay an extra tariff to download it?
Absolutely. And what's interesting with them is in, I think, 2015, 2016, the lead singer was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, underwent surgery, did chemo, all that. They toured to support an album, and it was kind of this question of like, is this a final tour, is it not? And then he passed away after the end of that tour, and then 4 months after that tour. But it was this thing of like, all of Canada, like when they made an announcement and had a press conference with his doctor. Like, that's how big of a deal this was. But I've been going through their discography, and it's just, it's very 80s, 90s feeling where I'm at so far. Kind of like somewhere between alternative rock grunge and like Bare Naked Ladies type vibe, but yeah. I'm having a good time with it.
I listened to a couple just as you're talking. Makes me want to play Guitar Hero. I don't know if like that like helps anybody, but like it's guitar. Like, I could feel like all of these songs would be on Guitar Hero and you'd be jamming out and having a good time.
Yeah, it would be great.
Yeah, I think that's a very, I have not listened to this band, but I do think that if you ever want to describe something, if you tell me it belongs on a Guitar Hero discography, I'm going to know exactly the vibe it's going for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm having a great time with that. It's very good. The other thing is a three-year-old reality competition show called Last One Laughing Canada. It's adapted, I think, from, I just learned about this. It's adapted from a Canadian or a Japanese game show. And the show is 10 comedians are locked in a room for 6 hours and you have to be the last one to laugh. So it is just watching comedians mess with each other for 6 hours. I'm two episodes in. There is a moment at the end of the first episode where Tom Green does what appears to be like 10, 15 minutes of the worst Johnny Carson style pun, how hot is it, dad jokes. But every joke that he's doing is the same premise of it was hot today. How hot was it? And then they have a live band in the room who's doing like stings at the end of every shitty punchline that he's doing. And you're just watching these people try to not laugh at like, this man is intentionally bombing in front of all of us, like horrifically. And then as he ends and like walks off the little stage that's in there for them to use to try to mess with each other, Andrew Fung from Kim's Convenience, played Kimchi, walks out of a back room with a saxophone, yells something, and just starts blasting it.
And, I have a visual in my head right now.
Same.
It's so good.
Same.
The absolute best part of this is watching these people try to thread the needle of what will make them break, but what won't make me break.
Oh, so you like, so it's any laugh. It's not just a laugh laughter inflicted on you by somebody else.
Somebody gets in trouble for laughing at their own stupid joke in a mirror. Like, they like put on an outfit and like giggle and it's like, hey, that counts. But there's a moment where do you know John Lajoie? He was on The League. The younger brother.
Oh, Taco?
Yeah, Taco.
Okay, yeah, he's a Taco. I know what you're talking about.
And there's this part where he approaches an actor who, I forget his name, he was on Letterkenny, and they both kind of start engaging in this bit, and they realize partway through that they're playing chicken and that, like, it is not going to end well for either of them. So they just both are like, I have to go, and just walk away from each other because they thought that they had the upper hand, and they were like, shit, you're going to make me laugh. Like, I can't do this. I can't be here right now. But that's the show, and it's been adapted in 28 countries after it started in Japan. So there's a lot of this online. You can watch it on Amazon. But yeah, I was like almost crying watching Andrew Fung blast a saxophone.
What was the name of it again, Alex?
Last One Laughing Canada.
Last One Laughing Canada. Cool. I'm gonna add it to the list. It sounds fun.
Yeah, it was the exact like lighthearted fun thing that I needed to watch this week.
Very nice. I like it.
Yeah, and surprisingly, I knew like half the people that were on there.
Yeah, you named like a whole bunch of people, and I was like, yeah, I want to see them try to make each other laugh. That sounds like a great time.
Oh yeah, there's Colin Mochrie's on there, Kevin Foley, Tom Green, Caroline Ray. Like, there's like big names in comedy, and from like a multitude of types of comedy and eras, and yeah, it's just great. So, recommend that one. And then before we get into the main thing, where can people find you online, Adrian?
Yeah, mostly. Oh, who even knows these days? Is anywhere good online anymore? I guess I'm mostly on Instagram and TikTok at SuperReese93 mainly, and then writing with But Why Though, as per usual. Right. Have some couple Monster Hunter stuff coming out here pretty soon from the preview event we did at Capcom. So look out for that. Very excited for that.
Nice. What about you, Kate?
I am pretty much mostly on Blue Sky. I'm a little bit on Instagram, but I don't post, like, I post like a picture where I'm like, oh, I looked cute, and then like depressing stories. So if you want like actual commentary on anything, you can go to my Blue Sky thing, which is just, oh, my Mithrandir.
Nice. And yeah, you can find me on Blue Sky, and only on Blue Sky, at most always Alex. Any other account that exists with that name is either not me or is not being paid attention to.
Is not mostly you.
Yeah, it's not mostly me. It's a lie. And with that, I think we just get into it. Posthumous work and unfinished work and how those kind of go hand in hand. I think the first thing that I wanted to do is kind of establish what we mean by that, because it's new work or like unseen versions of old work, whether it's completed or not. If I say anything that doesn't ring true to you for this category, let me know. I think if it's not completed, there's also this, and I'm sure you guys have seen this, where it's completed by somebody else.
Yeah.
Who is trusted either because they're family or they're an artist that they had worked with, or they had laid out just a ton of notes of this is what's supposed to happen next. And then it's,
oh, Berserk
not,
falls in that category.
Mm.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. And then there's also like not really media about the deceased necessarily. That gets into a side, very related conversation of like how we treat legacy and image. And then last performances, I think, are also kind of a part of this, because that's I want to say a last performance is kind of as close as like an actor will get to it in a weird way, because like an author, it's like, oh, I was working on this thing. And for an actor, that's their working on a thing.
Yeah.
And so, it, you know, it might not be intended or anything. And it's not like they're going to dig up archive footage of here's a whole movie that this actor made before they died. But yeah, so for recent examples of this, there was Now and Then by the Beatles. Did you guys see this? So Now and Then is the last Beatles song, and it was originally a demo in the late 70s that John Lennon did, just kind of a very like wistful, sad, you know, song.
Yeah.
And then in the 90s, they had, I found this out, a tape of a tape of a tape of the demo. And they tried to use that as the foundation for recording a song. And they scrapped it because George Harrison was like, I think this sounds terrible. And they were, I think the way that Paul McCartney phrased it is the Beatles are a democracy. So that was enough to kill it. And then after the Get Back documentary, where Peter Jackson had this whole technology developed that like basically like gets the hiss and cassette noise and like the poor audio quality off of recordings. And so they had that technology, and then they had the original cassette from John Lennon's son. So they weren't using a copy of a copy of a copy anymore.
Yeah.
So they extracted it, and then they took George Harrison's guitar parts that he had recorded in the 90s, and they just like put in the work to like finish the song, like round out the lyrics and make it like nice and neat and write in all the parts that were missing. And so Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney just released a Beatles song like a year or two ago.
See, that one feels weird. I don't like it. Like, I feel like if somebody said this should not see the light of day, and then you choose to go through extreme measures. It's kind of like somebody had a DNR, like a do not resuscitate.
Yeah.
And then they were like, just let me die. And then somebody came in and was like, knowing that, yeah, but I can't let you die. And then performs extreme measures to bring that person back. And they have like a bruised rib and like living on a ventilator. But hey, they're back. That's what this feels like.
I will say for that, George Harrison's wife, I think, confirmed that like his issue wasn't with the song. It was with the quality of the recording.
Oh, okay. Well, then I retract my statement.
Yeah. But no, but I agree, because there was that. I did have that question when I saw that he didn't like it, where I was like, is the song bad or is the sound quality bad? Because those are two different things to be upset about.
So, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, that was all.
Was this, because like I do have a question. Like, I know that was a music one, and looking at the notes, like there's the movie, because I'm curious as to where this falls into it. Because when we think about last performance, because you don't have it listed anywhere, the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
I was thinking about that one because that was one where they, so that was Heath Ledger, right?
Yep.
And to get around it, instead of like completing it with a body double and CGI faces like they did with Paul Walker, this one, they just were like, well, that's part of the character, is that he's constantly changing bodies. And that's actually really interesting, because at that point, the performance is him, but it's not. It's like making him part of an ensemble.
Yeah.
Whereas like we see a lot of people, I think, would probably say like The Dark Knight, because that's what I think of when I think of a posthumous performance from him.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is actually a really good point of like, how does that fit in? Because they sort of rewrote the role to be him and not be him anymore.
Because I think that like that probably, I think, feels more akin to the George Harrison example and Now and Then, because I feel like if you have something that was completed and released, that is a posthumous release. But I think where you get into the murky territory is it's where it's half complete. They did half, yes. Like, I think Troll Hunters is a good example of that as well. Anton Yelchin's voice is used for a lot of it.
Oh, man, That was out of my head.
Yeah, I cried. Also, that last episode was a good, like, honor to get somebody out. Sorry, I'm derailing. Mm-hmm. But, like,
I want to talk about.
Like, unlocked a lot in my head, because, like, I feel like there are moments, because I know that, like, when Imaginarium came out, a lot of people saw it as, like, an honor to just get the release out, because it's, like, this was the last thing he did. And I think as we continue with this conversation, I guess that's the question. And even with you adding the extra context that George Harrison was just mad at the quality, not the song, it's kind of like, well, if you like, where is the line between fulfilling the person's wishes and honoring them? And where is the line between exploitation? I think kind of keeping that in our mind as we talk about it.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge thing, is like how we interact with it and what the intention was behind it. Because we've all seen releases where it's like, this is a cash grab. Like, this is when, you know, someone's like, oh, here's our third unreleased recordings. And it's like, these are clearly demos that they cranked out at 2 a.m. This was not something that they meant to commercialize.
Yeah.
And you're preying on something like psychologically. We'll get to it. But yeah, they're like that line, and that is something to be very mindful of. The other good example that I found, Richard Wright, author of Native Son, Black Boy, had written a novel called The Man Who Lived Underground in the 40s, and nobody wanted to publish it. So he released parts of it as like in short story anthology compilations.
He had a blog before a blog.
I mean, basically. And then he released a truncated novella where he was like, I'm going to cut out a lot of this. And they later found out that part of what he cut out was part of what made publishers tell him that they wouldn't publish it. Not because it was like, this is bad writing, but they were like, this is a little bit too real, a little bit too raw. Because I think it was, it's Richard Wright. Like, just a lot of what he did writing about race in the 40s, like, that was going to be touchy. And then his daughter in, like, 2015 or something had, like, oh, here's a manuscript of it. And there was a total of 6 manuscripts of the whole book. And so they got an editor, and it was like, your job is to go through all these manuscripts, find all the differences, find all his little notes, and compile what is the truest version of this book that he always wanted to publish. And so that came out in 2021, like a solid 50 years after he, or 40 years after he died, I think. No, more than that. When did Richard Wright die? Why don't I know this? But decades after he passed away, this book comes out, and almost a century after he wrote it. I mean, literally 80 years after he wrote it. And then the last one is, and Kate, you might know about this one, The Amusement Park by George Romero.
I do.
Yeah. Adrian, do you know about this one?
I don't. Tell me about it.
So The Amusement Park was a commissioned film that was supposed to be an educational movie about elder abuse. And so George Romero, being a horror director, made a film about somebody going to a theme park and transforming into an old person and just realizing all of the neglect and poor treatment that elderly people get.
Ah, like that episode of American Dad.
Is that an episode of American Dad?
It is, yeah.
It's incredible. But the company basically, I think they said they might have used it for a little bit, or they just like shelved it immediately. But they were like, this is not quite what we were looking for, Mr. Romero. And then in 2017, his widow was like mailed a copy that some film festival had. And she, I think she had it on a shelf, and people were like, we want that. Like, that's like a work of his that's known and believed to be lost. So that one has the fun thing of being lost media and posthumous media.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was going to be like my, where does it fit in of like, what did like the fans want? Right. I think
that's such a part of this.
Because for the example that I was thinking of, as like we're sitting here, the more and more I think about it, like the more like Mac Miller is a great mm-hmm. example of like how to do it correctly, because the Balloonerism came out earlier this year, and it was mm-hmm. something that he'd been working on since 2014. He'd already done artwork for it. He'd already been talking about releasing it. It was like leaked a bunch. Some of the tracks were like leaked, so things were finished. But if you know Mac Miller fan base, they're diehard for Mac mm-hmm. Miller. So how much does that album releasing help people?
Yeah.
Given his fan base and given all the things that he talks about in his songs and things like that. So some of it too, I think, has to be like, what would they want for their fans? And I think releasing stuff for most part seems like a good idea, but how do you do it? Yeah. I think is like the harder part.
Yeah. I think that's where I struggle with it, because I don't think anything should just be released for a fan if the person yeah. doesn't intend it to be. I think mm-hmm. that's where my yes. thing is, because I do think that there is a conflated parasocial relationship that fandoms have gotten, especially in the era of social media, where I think they expect to receive every ounce of somebody's being. And I think sometimes yeah. there can be like, where is that line? That actually sounds like a perfect example on how to do it, in that like this was something mm-hmm. he wanted, and you have it serving both sides. And I'll talk about my one where I have questions I about what fans want or not
no,
later.
Because
that's like the most extreme example, I think, of,
yeah.
of that I can think of. Yeah. I mean, and also we're biased because, you know, we're Texans and yada, yeah. yada, yada. But like, you know, it's worth the conversation.
Yeah, no, I think we get into it. I mean, we've laid out some examples, and really what this comes down to is, what did the artist intend for this art, and how are audiences to receive it, and where is our interest even coming from? And also, since the artist is gone and cannot release it, who's releasing it and why?
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I've definitely seen somewhere it's like, as I was researching this, it was like, posthumous album released that like Warner Brothers Records or whatever chose to release. And it's like, oh, so like this wasn't like the family or the estate or like other musicians who worked with this person. This was, you found some recordings of somebody and you slapped them on a CD and you sold it.
Yeah.
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 And that, yeah, just feels gross. But Kate, do you want to talk about your thing in this?
Yes. Selena Quintanilla Perez, the queen of Tejano, the woman who inspired me for the majority of my life, who died at 23 and was gone too soon. It sucks. Because I think that there, yep. like with her and her legacy, I think that there is a very large understanding. And I think to Adrian's point about fans, is that what Selena did for so many people was she gave validity to being Mexican American. And I say that very specifically mm-hmm. because I think a lot of the times when we talk about Latinidad in the United States, it is othering everybody to be somebody foreign and to be an immigrant coming from somewhere else. What Selena represented was a Mexican American, which a lot of us, we can trace our roots here to before the border moving, right? Like we can, mm-hmm. we are very intrinsically, and in Texas, especially with the Tejanos, like we are a product of the land that we have lived in, that our families have lived in. And she represented that, I think, especially for young girls and especially for the beauty standards of the time. But when she dies tragically, she's murdered. She does not just die. Mm-hmm. She's murdered very tragically. You have her first posthumous release, which is Dreaming of You, and her final studio album, where they finish some of her songs and release them. And it's an iconic work. You have the recordings marketed and played out from the Houston show, which, again, iconic work. Her iconic purple outfit, her like every the carriage ride, those are cornerstones. And I think that fits into the Mac Miller of it all, where it was like this was the thing they were working on. Because the reason that Dreaming of You was important was because it was supposed to be her crossover into the English language mm-hmm. space when she had been sequestered in Spanish language Tejano. And so you have this honor coming with it, and then you have the biopic in 96 that comes out. And that, okay, still honoring her, barely close to after when she died. So I think there's some questioning
that
happened there.
That is a confusing part.
But, you know,
I hadn't considered that. This is a movie I've seen many times, and I never thought about how this was like, yeah, it's too soon.
Yeah. but, you know, like, adult eyes will ignore that. That's fine. And then you have the first release of fashions inspired by her drawings. You have makeup lines. MAC specifically is what the Quintanilla family has been working with. I have bought two of her signature red lip, it's like a bustier themed palette, all that stuff. And so you have all these pieces of her, like very specifically being marketed and sent out. And then there's this hard pivot in the late 2010s where you start to understand, a lot of people start to be more vocal, and this is right when the Netflix series gets greenlit, of the Quintanilla family and a lot of the understandings of how they have been within Tejano Music and Abraham's more general role, which has been, since her death, him kind of taking the centerpiece of everything. And that is where we really start to see this real inflection point of questioning whether or not this is exploitation of somebody who is past, or if you're honoring. And then in 2022, you get, I think it's like the Moonlight Mixes or something, that may be wrong, but like, I think it's called the Moonlight Mixes. And that gets a release date, and it is, there are accusations of fake voices. There is cleanup. There is a lot of questioning as to whether this is releasing something Selena intended to be released, or if it is something where the Quintanillas needed to release something, especially aligning to the release of the Netflix series. And so I think that, like, it's been the hardest thing for me to grapple with, because I think there is a lot of pressure and issues from the fan base of it, because she is, like, she's the closest thing to a saint for a lot of people. Like, you don't talk about her. You don't badmouth her. And I mean, to this effect, the most recent Selena documentary, Selena y Los Llenos, came out at Sundance, and they actually had to pull it down from the online platform, because people were pirating it immediately and putting it up in 3-minute clips on Instagram and TikTok. And I'm like, this is why Mexicans can't have anything.
That's wild. And I'm not surprised. I am so not surprised by that.
It is the first time it has happened in the 5 years that they have done this online platform.
That they've had to pull a movie.
Yes. And then the Dylan O'Brien stands did it with Twinless. So it wasn't just the Mexicans who did it. So we can be okay there. But we did inspire a movement of piracy.
Anything for Selena.
Anything for Selena. Absolutely. Not like that, though. Not like that. And I think that this is like where we get right into this really interesting territory, because we have the release of her personal music, right? So that's her stuff, where it is a posthumous release. And then you have stuff that is done about her. And while we're not talking about that specifically, I think it's pertinent to this conversation, because you have a woman's legacy and memory being used to fund a family, and more importantly, place her father, Abraham Quintanilla, at the center of it all, when there has been noted issues between it. Like, the Jackson 5 comparisons between them aren't because it's ha 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 funny, like, cool, they're a little Mexican family that has a group. No, it is because he was like the dad. And I think that this is where we have to call into question, like, and I think, like, it's crazy because, like, Mac Miller is the great example. Selena posthumous V1, good example. Selena posthumous V2, the stuff you do not do, because at a certain point you are exploiting a legacy.
How much do you think? How much do you think, like, the manner? I mean, and I guess for Alex, for this whole conversation, how much does, like, the manner of the death affect these things? Because I think, like, when that happens initially, V1, it's very fresh. We want to be able to, like, now we're, like, far away, and we're like, okay, like, what are we doing here? Well, you know, and Mac Miller's death, same thing, right? Like, the music that's in Bloomerism is very much in line with, like, his battles with mental health and how he lost his life and stuff like that. So if he had died some other way, I don't know, like, if they released the music the same way, or if it means the same to, like, certain people. But does that matter at all when it comes to, like, Selena specifically? Because there's a lot that goes into, like, how she died and, like...
It is. No, you're not wrong. Yeah, because, like, she was, and I think that this is the important thing, which I think is, like, where we get into a lot of the conversations about this, is I think that if we look at this purely through, like, altruistic things, is Selena died at the peak of her career. she was murdered by somebody. And so it was a taken too soon narrative. And it has been one of those things for Latinos specifically who are consistently erased from pretty much every media. Like, our numbers decline every single year in the Amberg research studies for representation in television and representation in film. And that's a reality despite making up the mm-hmm. bulk of the minority population of the United States. And there is a lot of talk that has consistently happened, whether it's from her family, her fans, or just people who exist as brown in this country. What would have happened if she had lived? What would have happened if she had kind of crossed that line? Because you do have a lineage, not to the point that the Selena series did, but like Beyonce has said that she listened to Selena growing up. Kiki Palmer has sang Selena, like mm-hmm. in interviews. There are so many threads of her impact that you can trace, but it cuts off. And so I can understand, because of the violence and suddenness of the death, wanting to preserve. But mm-hmm. I think when you like pull back the context of the way the Quintanillas, and I think like this is the other thing to be very clear, it's a very important piece of context that I did leave out. Selena y los Dinos, which is the Sundance documentary, is the first time Chris Perez has been allowed to give his story alongside the Quintanillas, her husband. Because the Quintanillas had cut him out of absolutely everything regarding her memory. They have complete control of her estate. They have complete control of how she is represented in the media. And that goes so far as shutting down people who do, like, really honoring, like nice impersonations, like, to sing and stuff like that. You have to get permission from the Quintanilla family. They shut down productions. And you have like some people who are like trying to quote unquote smear Selena or anything, but like Selena is very much, it was not a joke what I mean, that she is like, her identity is protected like somebody who is holy. And that is what I think kind of perverts the usage of her, because mm-hmm. it's not fair use, because she's not everybody, despite everybody's investment in her. And I think at first, the violence of her death is what made everything come out very fast. I even had a Barbie doll of her. But mm-hmm. I think in the years as it's cooled, you see the control aspect that feels very focused on creating a situation where if it is not in their control, then it can't be there. And it sucks, because I'm kind of like, I feel like my mom would do that if I died. Like, I feel like she would very much like not let people like say things or smear things. But I think that there is a line, which I guess to your comment, Adrian, about like, where do fans fall into this, where it is very much like, do you protect somebody so much that they can only be released in the version that you want them? And that version just so happens to be the way that makes you the most money. Netflix series that everybody hated and put mountains in areas of Texas where there are no mountains. I think that that's a very big thing. This is also why I had this idea for this episode, because I think it's a very it's an inflection point, and it's a thing that I think is very thorny and prickly and complex, and it really has to do with how you feel about the person.
Yeah, and I don't think we're not any better at handling it either.
No, right?
No,
we're really
we've
not.
Learned nothing.
We've learned nothing. We've,
yes.
Yeah, I the album that gave me the, like, you know, this like, oh yeah, there's something to talk about here, is tomorrow, as of recording this, the band Low Roar, that you might not have heard of ever. They're an Icelandic band, but their founder was an American immigrant. They did most of the soundtrack for Death Stranding. Yes. an expat. No. So this band did most of the soundtrack for Death Stranding. And then in 2022, the lead singer passed away, and the band was like, he recorded enough that we can finish the album that we were working on. Just give us some time. And they finally are like, hey, we're releasing the album. And this is like a very, like, we're not trying to cash in. We literally, like, it's shorter than I think their other albums have been. They're just working with what he recorded and, like, you know, wrapping it up based on his notes and what he'd already done. And that again goes back to the, like, this feels like a very honoring way to do it. Like, Selena was working on an album and then was murdered, and then they were like, okay, the album is still coming out. Like, this is an important thing. But I think this also kind of goes to that immediate raw reaction of like movies, dolls, albums coming out, you know, in the almost immediate aftermath of a death is, I think a lot of the interest that audiences have in posthumous releases, unfinished works, is you just want more of that person, like you were talking about, Kate. And it's like a way to pretend that they're still with you is it's so intense in the aftermath, where it's like, no, Selena didn't get shot. Like, here's her new album. And like, just like kind of tricking yourself a little bit. And I think that I totally get that from the human side of it. But then you see the people who are like, I'm going to cash in on this. Like, I'm going to exploit that little like psychological need that people are having right now to make money. And that's where it gets really tricky. Like, we talk about capitalism constantly on the show, and the fact that like even the works of a dead person are not going to be respected. I was telling you guys before this, John Steinbeck like very plainly said, I don't want my letters ever being published. And guess what has been published? Like, it's, if you can make money off of it, someone is going to try. And yeah, I think there's just this like absolute caution that we should be approaching those works with. Because there is a difference between, you know, the question is, well, how done was it? You know, is this they ran it 70% of the way and you padded it? Or is this they had an outline and you wrote the whole book? Because those are two very different things. And I actually was reading, I came across, it was an article on, let me find the website, JSTOR Daily, which is apparently like kind of pop culture-y focused daily magazine, and it's all tied into like an open source database of journals. But it's this article by Ashanta Jackson from 2021 talking about the philosophy of posthumous releases. And the idea that it hits on toward the end is it's this paper by these two philosophers, Bacharach and Tolleson. And the way they phrase it is, there is an incomplete work and one complete work which contains the incomplete work as a source material. And the idea that like what the artist made is one thing and what got released is another thing that contains it, but is not necessarily it. And there's room for this like conceptually and historically in art of like working together and things being done where someone is acting on your behalf to do it. But there is that question of like, are those posthumous releases even fully them? Or, you know, and in some instances, when it's something someone was literally working on when they died, yes. And then there's also that question, though, of like record companies digging out old, you know, 2 a.m. demos and making it a deluxe box set for $89 at, I'm going to go for a real dated reference and say Borders.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, it's just a really weird, tricky, ugly thing. To try to navigate, but I get it though, because like I do like seeing like posthumous works and seeing unfinished things. To me, appeal the same way that concept art does, where it's just like a fun way to kind of see what could have been or how their creative process went.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it feels really weird. I'm trying to remember her name. She was at the Hanno Singer, and they did like a projection of her. Like, remember when they were doing hologram concerts?
Oh, like the Michael Jackson,
yeah,
Tupac
stuff? Yeah, exactly. When Prince was like, when I die, never do this. Well, because it's technically it's a posthumous performance.
Yeah, it is.
That you're digging up and putting and selling tickets to.
And they're not making money off of it. Who's making the money? Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Which, it is giving me a new appreciation for understanding why people were angry at the use of that actor in Alien Romulus for the android.
Ian Holm. Yeah.
Ian Holm, yes. And so it was one of those where they're like, no, we did not use AI. We did not deepfake. This was all practical effects. And it was, we had an actual voice actor voice match in the way voice actors do. Hi, Troy Baker as young Harrison Ford, looking at you. You were perfect.
They also talked to his widow about it. And were like, hey, do you think he'd be okay with this?
Exactly. They're like, no, we would think he would want to stay a part of the Alien franchise because he did not get to do more work. And we would like him to have more credits. But even with that context, you end up into the other thorny category where now, because of de-aging and resurrecting dead actors, how convoluted that section has gotten, that I think people are like, this is bad. Like, inherently bad. We don't know the wishes of the person. How much, which I guess kind of wraps in with the Selena thing, like, how much do we let a family make the decisions? And where, like, are we even, like, can we even draw that line, right?
Yeah.
It sucks. It's complicated. This is a way
better. Better write it down before you go. And then
I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do want to say, before we get back into how complicated this is, did you see the thing that Harrison Ford said about Troy Baker?
Mm-mm.
He said, this is the quote, "You don't need artificial intelligence to steal my soul. You can already do it for nickels and dimes with good ideas and talent. Baker did a brilliant job, and it didn't take AI to do it."
Mm. Yes, Harrison Ford, you remain king. I love you, my man. Right.
Looking at you, it's Star Wars. Stop the aging Mark Hamill, please.
Please.
Stop the aging Mark Hamill, please. I'm tired of it.
And then it just gets an uncanny valley. I think that this is like the other question too. I think all of this, I'm going to make a really bad analogy, but this reminds me of the Supreme Court decision where they were like, well, no pornography when we see it. And I think that that is where a lot of this comes down to. Where does it feel bad? Why doesn't it feel bad? And why does it? And it feels like, at least popularly, it is where the bad vibes keep going that kind of sets the tone.
But who sets the tone, sucks, though? Do the fans set the tone? Do the families set the tone?
Do critics set the tone?
Who sets the tone on like what's bad, right? Because I think about like Lance Riddick, and like when Lance Riddick died, dude, how much everybody Destiny 2 was more. Back? Everyone wanted more. We were back in Destiny 2 again. You know, like there's, and then does Destiny 2 get to do a whole bunch of memorial things and where they're going to get a bunch of more people playing their game and stuff? Like,
does that feel icky? Yeah.
Does that feel icky? Yeah. But then does it really feel icky? Because like everyone knows how much they loved Lance Riddick in like that franchise. I don't know, man. It's so icky. Like,
well, because like even when I think about it, so like when Kentaro Miura died, the author of Berserk, it was the first time my husband ever walked into the room and said, "Spend money," because he knew that I had wanted the leather bound omnibus versions of Berserk and I had not bought them yet, and he knew that they were gonna go up because they were already hard to get. So he was like, "Buy all the ones you can get yourself a T-shirt too," The thing that happened there is you ended up with a lot of people doing like memoriams, but there isn't anything like directly tied to his work other than that he greatly inspired dark fantasy. So large swords, all of the Final Fantasies, Castlevania, like you ended up with a whole bunch of different, even Bloodborne, different areas giving him the props that he deserved. But then a lot of people before it was announced were okay with the work ending because Berserk had not finished yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came out that one of his, I think it was one of his background artists, or friends. I don't remember. Please don't quote me on that. Somebody very close to the work of Berserk and Kentaro Miura started picking it up to finish. And his justification was, it was personal between the two of us. I know how he wanted this to end. And now it's up to me to kind of get to that ending. And so he went to continue it. And people, like, I think that that was probably one of the largest divides that I have felt when it comes to manga and anime, because when Akira Toriyama died, like, he already has such a lineage of things and has handed it off to different people in the past, that there's not that much argument around it. Totally. This was something that was never finished, never done, and like, we don't know how Guts' story ends. And that was when I first kind of saw that, because I do think it is a question like of who wants it, because like, if I'm the friend of the guy who died before his like life's work is complete, I'm going to try to finish the thing for my friend because that's what he would have wanted. But then the fans were like, "Don't touch it. You're not him." And I think that that's where, like, I think it's a good reason to bring that up, Adrian, of like who sets the tone, because it's kind of like, ultimately, fans don't know these people.
Yeah, right. Because they don't know that person, right? It's not parasocial for his homie, right? Like, that's someone who he actually knew, not just people who wanted their leatherback omnibuses. Because you know what I mean. So it's tough. It's super, super tough. I think I side with whatever is like the closest relationship. Well, even then, it's hard because then you have Selena, and then like those are her closest relationships, and then they just like screwed her over.
It's hard.
What is the answer?
Don't die.
Well, I mean,
don't die.
Get plasma blood.
Upload. Just do what they do in. Yeah, upload.
No, I was going to say get plasma bags from your children and infuse them with yourself so that you never die and you de-age like that one man in that Netflix documentary.
That's also very smart. I was going to say you do the Mr. Rogers where you just record like a solid 10 years of material and then like you have complete oversight over at least like the remainder of your image for that.
That works, yeah.
Which, yeah, I forgot that he did that. But yeah, Mr. Rogers like recorded, like basically banked a bunch of episodes.
I just like that he like, even when he was like, I'm going to die soon, I must think of the children.
Yeah,
absolutely.
As Mr. Rogers would do.
But yeah, it is. It's so interesting. I think that the other big one that I want to talk about, and I don't know as much about this, is J.R.R. Tolkien. Because if you look at his bibliography, there's like four or five things before he died, and then there's like 20 things.
Yes. So the work of J.R.R. Tolkien is a lot. So the way that this works essentially is you have his works that are published under his name that were fully written by him, and all the posthumous stuff was stuff that was found within his collection by his family. Christopher Tolkien is the head of, like, literally he founded the study of his father, essentially. Like, that, like, Tolkien studies is a very big thing because Tolkien's work is the backbone of every single high fantasy story now. Dungeons and Dragons, that leads back to Tolkien. Dragon Age, that leads back to Tolkien. All of these themes lead back to his work, and so it's a very large study. But it also means that because it's foundational, there are certain protections that they have seen that they have to put in place. But at the same time, there's also stuff that they released. So the appendices and the Silmarillion, I believe the Silmarillion released after his death.
So things that released before his death.
Yes.
The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, like the whole trilogy. Mm-hmm. And then a Adventures of Tom Bombadil and other verses from the Red Book, which is a poetry book. Yes. And The Road Goes Ever On, which is also a poetry book.
Yes.
That's it. That's all he released before he died.
So I'm going to say this here. And I think we unleashed the cap on being able to cuss on this podcast. Tolkien was a fucking nerd. Like, he was a linguist.
Oh, yeah.
He was a linguist who really wanted to make cohesive languages. And that is why he created Middle Earth. And I think this is also why it led to his family publishing his other pieces, because throughout all of Tolkien's stories, the majority of Tolkien's stories, there are references to myths, legends, people, places, times, things. And what this nerd did was he made little appendices to each of them to then go and write the Ballad of so-and-so to tell you what happened in that one thing that was referenced by the Ents on one page and never spoken about again. And I think with the release of the appendices specifically, we're in a situation where it brings out more life to the work that was created, because it fills in gaps and completes a world that has become foundational. And I think especially for me, like as a woman who reads Tolkien's work, it's also where we find some of the references to some of like really great romances and other women that aren't just Galadriel or Eowyn. And I think that these are situations that I think really kind of are in the honoring. I do think it is one of those, is like, did homeboy just make it for himself so he could like scroll away his little nerdy writings and then those fanfics didn't work and so he like went on with something else? We don't know. Yeah. And the Silmarillion specifically, I think it's a hard read, but it really takes care of developing the earlier stages of Middle Earth before we meet it in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And it's pretty foundational to setting up what happens. So that's how that.
But it's basically a history book.
It's
right?
A history book. Yeah, it's a history book. You might as well get like your little sticky notes and like highlight stuff. And that is like the other thing too. And I think to Adrian's point again about the fans, I don't know a single person who loves Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings that was like, yo, I gotta go read the appendices. I got to go read the Silmarillion because you have to be a very, I genuinely do think you have to be a very specific Lord of the Rings sicko to dig that deep, because it is just digging in a well of incompleteness. There are some stories that don't finish because he didn't finish them. And I think that that's also the important thing, is there isn't an edge to complete something that Tolkien didn't do. It is very much preserved in the context with which Tolkien wrote it, which I think keeps it as something sacred and
keeps it alive.
Yes, exactly. It keeps it alive. And the Tolkien estate has complete control. Nothing is done with Tolkien's works without, well, specific parts of Tolkien's works. Other parts are owned by the Embracer Group. But the Tolkien estate approves a lot of things. One of those things very particularly being the Rings of Power. Christopher Tolkien and the Tolkien estate has approved every single thing that happens in there. But the biggest thing, which is also the biggest issue with the Rings of Power, is that it cannot actually touch or adapt the Silmarillion. When it comes to adapting Tolkien's work, you can use the appendices, you can use anything else, but you cannot touch the Silmarillion because that history book, which is kind of boring and kind of hard to read, is what everybody has viewed as Tolkien's seminal piece. And because of that, it is protected. It's kind of in the different way of Selena, where Selena's family is like, only we can reproduce things about our daughter. You cannot touch it. They are very much like, if you are not J.R.R. Tolkien, you cannot touch this. And that is something that is going to be coming into contest now, because Christopher Tolkien is very close to the end of his life, and we don't know what's going to happen after this. We've already seen things changing in the video game landscape. The first animation in a very long time with War of the Rohirrim, which is very good and the smartest way to adapt a Tolkien thing, if you ask me. Because it is literally like a paragraph. Like, that entire thing that we watched in that movie is a paragraph in the appendices. That, like, Hera isn't even named. Very smart. That was a very long Tolkien rant. But it's interesting and fascinating because it kind of runs against everything else that we have mentioned here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, it brings family. Yeah, I was gonna say, I think for me, it brings in, like, is there like a time limit on this stuff? Like, how long do these people got to be gone for us to be like, okay, they've been gone for like a long time, let's see if we can adapt. And I mean, obviously, like, the rights stuff, obviously, to come up for like free use and stuff. But is there a time limit? Like, has it been there enough time for us to like get some new stories because of how important and how good it was? Because if we're not getting other stories that are on par of this foundational thing in high fantasy, should we go back to the basics and like restart this thing with some stuff that no one's seen or has been able to like produce in a different way?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I want to bring this back full circle with a really dumb question. Do you think J.R.R. Tolkien was right to tell the Beatles no when they asked to adapt The Hobbit?
Yes! 100%!
Or was it Hobbit or Lord of the Rings? We could have had John Lennon as Gollum.
No!
Who wants that?
No!
No!
No, I agree. I think he absolutely made the right call, and it's still one of the weirdest things that they ever tried to do.
Look, I still maintain that nobody should ever be allowed to make The Hobbit other than that, like, 1970s, like, animated thing, because nobody's done well with it. It's not...
Oh, yeah. No, not at all.
Come on. You needed three movies to... No, it's no.
Well, that's because
no,
we had to put the appendix in on.
Hey, the game's pretty fun. Hey, the old school Xbox game's pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, and, like, the funny thing is I actually think if you ask Lord of the Rings fans what the best piece of Lord of the Rings media is that has released since Peter Jackson's, it is the Lord of the Rings Online.
Yeah.
That is their answer, which is an MMO that has been around for decades at this point.
I mean, the game, I'd say, like, the game's period. Like, it's such a fun sandbox, and, like, Shadows of Mordor is, like, a fun sandbox.
Tales from the Shire.
Yeah. There's so much cool stuff in, like, that sandbox. I hope that we get more of it, but Rings of Power, you can't do it if you don't have the source material. It's too tough because you're not Tolkien.
I hate it too because, like, you watch Rings of Power and you see the ways in which these people deeply love Lord of the Rings. Like, there are small little references that you only know if you have read, like, that really stupid appendices in this one thing. Like, this is how the face of God shows himself type thing. And you can just see where they're, like, kind of beholden to the gaps that they have. And then the last episode of the first season, the last episode of the second season, beautiful and nailing what Tolkien meant with his work, but also everything in between is
should you even do it? Is it even worth doing if you can't do it right?
Which I will say, like, the Tolkien estate, which I think has been really interesting, is I think that they have been fairly liberal, especially when it comes to, like, and I don't really have much control over the video games, but I think they've been very liberal in understanding of what you can build on top of it, but they have been very protective of what the existing pieces are. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like, if my father told the story this way, you cannot tell it a different way. It must happen in this, like, this way, beginning, middle, end. And I think that, like, it's going to be interesting to see when Christopher Tolkien dies, because I've grappled with this a lot, Adrian, in that because people listening, I don't know if you know, like, my name is Mithrandir on Twitter. Like, it's literally Lord of the Rings reference, the name of Gandalf. I have invested a lot of, like, my life and sanity into Lord of the Rings, as in a way that I don't talk to people about it so much because I do not want it to be touched. And I kind of feel like I understand what it's like to have something that is so important to you. But I also think that the thought of that dying out and not being picked up by another generation.
Yeah, that's where I'm kind of coming
that
from.
Is scarier. And yeah. So, like, I hadn't really thought about that till you brought that up, Adrian. But, like, it is just kind of like, if we don't allow iteration and development of something, are we okay with it dying? Because we are coming to a point in media where everything that has happened in the past is easily erased. Like, what do we do to preserve it? What do we do to keep it alive? And it is these adaptations. It is these iterations. It is allowing things to become bigger than their source. I think we just have to go around it a different way, which I know we have detracted from posthumous works.
Yeah.
But
it's, again, there's just there's a time and a place, and there is a right and a wrong way to do it. And it really is, you know, a small piece of a Venn diagram right in the middle. But when you can hit all of those notes of respecting their image and respecting their work, but continuing it and expanding it and, like, honoring their intention, you get really cool stuff when you can do that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, like, what did you all think about the Fortnite concerts? Like, Juice WRLD had a Fortnite, like, they did a concert in Fortnite for Juice WRLD. I only knew who Juice WRLD was because I listened to the posthumous song that he released with Yoongi from BTS. But like, what did you all think? Because that's another thing that's happening now too, when you look at a virtual space.
I mean, that's up there with the hologram concerts, yeah, kind of. It's not quite as same, because I assume it wasn't a photorealistic avatar. Yeah. But it's like, it's going that direction.
Yeah.
The whole, like, let's bring people back with holograms, and that's, like, its own kind of gross. That
didn't
I'm just like,
touch on, yeah, the and like, aging and
yeah, like,
why did we,
like, in a concert? Yeah, I just don't. Yeah, it feels better in Fortnite. I don't know why, but it feels better in Fortnite. I know it shouldn't, but it feels better in Fortnite.
I kind of get where you're coming from.
Yeah,
it was,
because that's,
it,
like,
was,
I mean, because also you got to think about, like, where's his demographic? You know, his demographic is going to be more in Fortnite
younger.
than So if you're going to honor him, you're not going to, those kids aren't going to go to, like, a concert, right?
Yeah.
Of a hologram, but are they going to go hang out in Fortnite? Yeah, for sure.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I will say the stuff I saw around it, which I was really surprised about, because I think I kind of, like, rolled my eyes a little bit, because I was like, I thought hologram concert, but, like, everybody I saw writing about it, and again, this is critic space, this is not just, like, pure fan space, some of it was overlap, but they were, like, actually, like, this was a lot more moving than I thought it was going to be. Like, this was a lot more acts, and I think, like, that this is going to be our biggest issue moving forward as a society. Like, genuinely, whether it is at a celebrity level or even a personal level, I think a lot about how, like, a lot of science fiction nowadays is, there's a show Sunny on Apple TV Plus, and there is a movie with Gong Yoo on Netflix called Wonderland, I believe, where you are able to keep the person that you love alive either through listening to them on a phone or, like, keeping their consciousness alive in an illusion where you can contact them in video calls, and they're not.
Isn't
really
that a Black Mirror episode?
This is the
it's
thing.
About torturing people.
No, so yeah, so this is the thing where it's weird, because Black Mirror did this. It was negative, and now
it
we're
was a
seeing
torture museum,
these
wasn't
movies
it?
And, like, these things happening, where it's not inherently evil. And it is hard having watched both things. Is it dystopian or utopian? I don't know, but
yeah, I mean, it's not as like highbrow and like the thing, but like up the series on Upload, the series on Prime, that where you can like upload your body, and they go into the whole thing of like, you uploaded to this thing, you know, Microsoft, right? So are you just property of Microsoft? Does your family have any say in your digital afterlife, your consciousness,
Pantheon, anything that you,
anything that you did before that? So if you upload Tolkien's mind, Tolkien's mind is part of the thing. So like, does that mean that you own all of Lord of the Rings now? Like, it's just, it's too dystopian, and I don't want that.
Yep, it's bad. I feel like the big question for me, and we don't need to get into the actual hypotheticals of storing someone's brain on a computer, is what does that person experience when the power is off? Because if I'm just blipping in and out of existence, watching my family rapidly age around me as they turn me on and off, that's a fucking nightmare.
Well, in upload, you better hope you have like a good data plan, because if not, you just like stay there and you're just frozen until you get more money on your account, and then that's scary.
Oh my god.
The 2 gigs. Like, they call them the 2 gigs.
Like, I can't hear anybody right now, but this makes it like consistently more wild that now it is being glamorized. And like, these other things are dealing with grief, yes, but it's like, oh, maybe it's kind of cool to have my husband's soul in this little robot thing.
I just realized the dumbest analogy is this is the human equivalent of like, well, what happens to a Pokemon when it's in the Pokeball?
Yeah. Really, that's what it is. Yeah. And if you're rich, you go on a nice, you know, vacation home. But if you're poor, you're just like stuck there in a room where you have to pay to think.
Oh my God.
This episode was really fun. And then it got dark.
What if you were rich and then you got uploaded and then your kids squandered your money and now you're just stuck in the void?
Now you don't know into like a grandchild or somebody pawned you off to
opened you up, and it's like, hi person, I don't know, I bought you at a pawn shop.
Yeah, uploaded you to like a razor, a Motorola razor. Ha, here you go. No.
You remember the museum guide in the time machine? It's just that.
It's just that, yeah.
Oh. Now I got a lot of dark stuff to think about.
You gotta laugh. We gotta laugh. We have to.
What is it? The Pet Sematary quote? Sometimes dead is better.
Sometimes dead's better. Dead is better. Sometimes dead's better. That's the theme of this episode.
There's your name, Jason. You got
there
it.
There you go.
All right, I think that does do it for this week. If you want more, we do have it, ButWhytho is on Blue Sky. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, and you can donate to the site by going to butwhytho.net/support. Everything that you give goes to the site, goes to paying writers, helping us to make the show, helping us to make the content you enjoy. So if you like what you do, we really would ask that you do that. It goes a long ways. Kate, Adrian, thank you guys so much for joining me for this conversation that was mostly about death and then got really dystopian and sci-fi at the end. I did have fun from start to finish. Thank you for joining me. And thank you at home for listening. I hope you enjoyed it too. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.